So I don't think it's a badge of dishonor in any way. But usually the writer who's a writer's writer is working usually at two levels, and one level is the kind of jazz master's level where some of the things that are going on might be, you know, appreciated more by fellow practitioners and instead of just an interested reader.
Yeah, I mean, what would you say about someone who's a doctor's doctor? You know, they're going to be the best at their trade. So it is a kind of funny expression in a way.
It is.
And if something that's great about writing can only be appreciated by other writers, is the writing still great? You know,
I think it's also the question of whether we're talking about the writer's writer as a writer who is largely unread or not well read, not read enough, so obscurity, or whether we're talking about somebody who has something which for whatever reason is instructive to other writers or contagious somehow, or somehow opens their vision of what's possible in the work. And those seem to me two different things, although often they come together.
Yeah.
I think another category worth adding to your categories is the writer who arrives to us in translation, so who is well known in their own country, celebrated in their own country, but who is obscure here. So I know when you were asking for a list of writers, I thought of, you know, most of the writers that I love are writers here, but perhaps not in their own country. Thomas Bernhardt, for example, the Austrian writer, or Bruno Schulz, who I'll talk about tonight, who in Poland certainly is a hugely celebrated figure, literary figure, but very obscure here.
Yeah, I feel I should warn you that there's been some inflation in the term, and I found out that John Ashbery called Elizabeth Bishop a writer's writer's writer. And I still can't actually figure out what that could mean, but, you know, so when we were emailing about this earlier, Jeff, you brought up, you know, what for you would be defining for this category, and you mentioned Nabokov's term, aesthetic bliss, which he mentioned in the afterword to Lolita, in the sentence, "For me, a work of fiction exists only insofar as it affords me what I shall bluntly call aesthetic bliss, that is, a sense of being somehow somewhere connected with other states of being, where art, curiosity, tenderness, kindness, ecstasy is the norm." So is that for you what would define who you think of in this way? And how do you interpret
that? That just sounds like good writing to me. I've always loved that quote, because that's exactly what I look for in a book. It sounds a little rarefied, aesthetic bliss, but I know what he means. I look for it in books when I read it. It's what I read for, really.
Yeah.
I think the sports metaphor, I mean, I'm preoccupied by the fact that the Tigers are playing the Yankees right now, so baseball player is baseball player. I don't know, but maybe in golf, certain people have a beautiful swing, and you'll hear the commentators talk about the swing, and yet the guy doesn't win the tournament often. So it perhaps is the difference between perfection of doing something and the other side is somehow, I don't know, getting some kind of major achievement done that is more clearly recognized on the stat sheet, and not just by the observer's connoisseurship, maybe.
Yeah. Well, so I was very interested, because I asked you before we came here to each send me a few names of people that you thought of in this way, and just to come back to what Nicole was saying, that there are these two ways of seeing this, whether you're talking about writers who have, for whatever reason, had a huge influence on other writers, or whether you're talking about writers who have simply been underappreciated by the general public. And I think you were both, in a way, including people that fell into both categories. But what was interesting to me was that between the three of you, there wasn't a single name that overlapped. You all mentioned completely different people. And so for me, it renders the whole thing not meaningless, but this is a huge category. Basically, you're saying who you love, who you love to read, and I also thought, Jeff, in your new novel, you described someone's personal library as a kind of personality test. So I thought maybe these lists were, in some sense, a personality test for you guys. But maybe we could start with your list of names, which included John Hawkes and Gilbert Sorrentino and Saul Bellow and Nabokov and Dennis Johnson. Nicholson Baker and Colm Turbine, among others. Mm-hmm. So what is defining for you about these people? What do they have in common?
Most of those writers obviously are stylists, and you might read them just for the pleasure of their sentences. It's funny that I included someone like Bella, who, you know, won more National Book Awards and Pulitzers than anybody else. So he's up, you know, I think you can be a writer's writer and be, you know, the toast of the town. I don't think it has to be the opposite of that. But those writers, for two, I guess they fall into two categories. There's the stylists like Bella and Nabokov, but then there's the writer's writers who maybe had a smaller audience because of the ferocity of their theoretical work. Sorrentino is a postmodern writer who on purpose wants to frustrate narrative pleasure and wants to always kind of thwart the expectation that is in most normal fiction, most realistic fiction. So that's why he's a writer's writer. To read him and to enjoy him, you have to know a fair body of literature and, you know, the nouveau roman that he's actually playing off of. The other ones, I think, are writer's writers just because of the luxuriance of their writing, the idiosyncrasy of their prose style, and the originality of it. That's why I put them in. Mm-hmm.
And you were going to read to us a short excerpt from a Dennis Johnson story.
I was. I also brought a Nabokov. It depends how long I'm supposed to talk about why it's a writer's writer. Because this one is more what I'm talking about. I'll just read this for now because I just was reading Panin. For some reason, that's the one of the only Nabokov books I haven't read, and I was going on in it that when I read it, I given in a story, but is known. I think my daughter is in the other room and can't hear me. His name is Fuckhead in the book, and he finally ends up in the hospital, and the man driving the car has died, and his wife is going in to see him, and there comes this paragraph. Down the hall came the wife. She was glorious, burning. She didn't know yet that her husband was dead. We knew. That's what gave her such power over us. The doctor took her into a room with a desk at the end of the hall, and from under the closed door, a slab of brilliance radiated as if by some stupendous process, diamonds were being incinerated in there. What a pair of lungs. She shrieked as I imagined an eagle would shriek. It felt wonderful to be alive to hear it. I've gone looking for that feeling everywhere. That was the line that Nicole made about, I've gone looking for that feeling everywhere.
Other writers in other parts of the world, and that writers are understood and respected in on a different scale than here. And I do think it's something worth addressing, because I think that most of these writers are American. I mean, I mentioned Pessoa, I would mention, say, Margaret Yourcenar in America, I would mention other writers in translation who don't penetrate, you know, the readership in this country in the same way. But I do think there's a different mentality toward what it means to be successful in America, in any level, in any discipline, career, what have you, but I think in terms of writing also. So I think there is a sort of cultural component to this strange term that we're talking about tonight. I also think that it's very particular to short story writers, because I do think that certainly in the United States and in other parts of the world too, the short story form remains sort of the underdog of literature, of prose fiction, always lesser to the novel, and so therefore writers who specialize in the short form, like Mavis and some of these other writers, like Andre Dubuis, they get the short shrift because of that, because less people are willing to read short stories, buy short stories, what have you, less publishers are willing to publish them, less agents are willing to sell them, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's just, nobody needs to belabor that point. But I do think there's a sort of, you know, I mean, if you look at the sort of, the other day I went on the site for the Ray Short Story Award, and they have all the list of all the people who received it, and, you know, I would say that 75% of them could be part of this panel conversation, you know, which is sad and infuriating to me personally. So there's that. But I feel like a writer's writer to me is, you know, and I'd like to hear what Jeff and Nicole think about this, but I feel like, you know, every writer wants to write as well as he or she can, you know, and I think that we all start out in a certain place. And nobody knows what's going to happen, but we all begin somewhere. And at some point, something brings us to our desks and we start writing something. And it turns into something that is our first book. And we write in complete ignorance and in darkness, and we have no idea, will this book ever even see the light of day? Will anyone ever read this apart from me and maybe my best friend or my mother or something, you know? And then after that point, whatever happens, happens. And for some people, it is success, and it is publication, and it is readership, and it is another book, and another one after that, and that sort of thing. And then for other writers, I mean, there are millions of ways that story plays out. But everybody writes a first book with a certain purity of vision, a certain innocence, and a certain intensity, and a certain integrity that I think is really, I think a writer's writer maintains that integrity, no matter what, even if he or she is on his fourth or fifth or tenth book. There's something about adhering to that purity of vision and not caring about whether this book will be popular or successful or if someone's going to, you know, give it a good review or a bad review, or people are going to buy it or not buy it. And I think that distinguishes the work of certainly the writers that I think of in that category. And, you know, partly it's a stubbornness, perhaps. You know, there's a certain sort of flying in the face of reality and bill paying and other things. But I still believe that that those writers maintain that insistence upon their craft and are not, their approach to their work remains intact and is not swayed by, oh, well, now I have all these people reading my books, or, well, now I've got this publisher, and I've got this agent, and I've got this readership, and now what do I do, you know? And I do think for certain writers that experience begins to shift and shape their attitude toward their work. If you look at a lot of sort of the earlier works of a lot of writers, they're much more idiosyncratic because they're written in that bubble, you know, that place of sort of isolation and purity, and then they actually become successful and the books necessarily take on a different character. Whereas I think with writers, the ones I really admire, there's that consistency of really just, you know, the excellence of the work, and nothing else is really coming into play.
Well, it may be also why you link this so much.
Countries, and some of them not at all, even though they are some of the greatest writers of their language. I suppose for me, the writer's writer is somebody who liberates the ordinary run-of-the-mill writer from having to pay attention to the kinds of things that maybe we grew up thinking we have to pay attention to, or that are necessary, rather the rules of storytelling, whether they have to do with development of character or a plot line that's continuous and linear and reaches a climax and a resolution, all those things that in the broad scope of novels the reader comes to expect. Maybe the writer's writer offers a kind of freedom in a way from the reader's expectations. Maybe that's another way of talking about this purity that Junko was alluding to. But for me, all of those writers gave me a sense of the shock of sort of everything being possible again, having come to certain terms of what a novel should be, or a story should be, or a poem, and then realizing, no, in fact, it could be something completely other. And some of those are very specific things. I mean, a writer like Thomas Bernhard was trained musically. His work is so much about music, about rhythm, really. And it can be infuriating to the reader. He loved to infuriate readers, which is also a very un-American thing. And sometimes I think part of why I love him is because sort of I come of age as a writer at a time when likability is so, seems so important. But a writer like Bernhard staked his life on disturbing and aggravating and provoking, but partly that was content of what he said, but also simply in the shape of the sentences, which can be incredibly repetitive, but are incredibly beautiful, and these strange significances seem to arise out of this endless repetition of ideas, each one slightly shifted. And then a writer like Yoram Kanyuk, who I discovered not very long ago, a couple of years ago, wandered into a bookstore, not a used one, but it seems even bookstores are going by the wayside. So, but there was a time when you could go in and browse, and I think this is a really important point because, of course, you can't browse on Amazon, or rather, the recommendations that come back to you, there are recommendations of more you-ness, the you you've always been, you know. And walking into a bookstore offers you this opportunity of surprise and serendipity, the thing that you never would have possibly discovered otherwise. Two very different things, one which solidifies us and one which has the possibility of changing us. So I walked into a bookstore and there was this book by this writer, Yoram Kanyuk, and the title was The Last Jew, so I couldn't really pass that title up. And then there was this quote from Susan Sontag on the cover about, you know, of all the writers in translation I discovered, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Hanke, and Yoram Kanyuk are the greatest. And I thought, who is this guy? I've never heard of him. And I read a lot of Israeli literature, and I found it strange that I hadn't heard of him. And that book, I mean, it was written more than 30 years ago. It was really despised when it was published in Israel. I mean, it was almost completely unread here, although it was republished recently. But it's a book that still reads now as if it were ahead of its time, as if we're still not prepared for it, and that has a lot to do with its form. I mean, it's made up of all these strange different forms, recorded interviews, all kinds of characters and perspectives which kind of mash together. And it's just a sort of masterwork that's, again, gave me that feeling of, wow, I had no idea this was even possible in a novel. So the writer that I thought of talking about, because again, I had this sort of schizophrenic confusion about, is a writer's writer somebody who has influenced lots of writers or who should be read more? And writers know that more than other readers, I don't know. But I thought of talking about Bruno Schultz, because he is so unusual in having really a small but serious cabal of writers who have tried to more or less resurrect him or rescue him in their work, whether by sort of almost bringing the sense of his world or his characters back to life, or literally bringing him and his lost work back to life. So just very briefly, in case any of you haven't heard of him, his story is sort of critical in all of this, which is that basically he was Jewish. He grew up in a small Polish town in I think southeastern Poland. And during the Holocaust, he was a painter and a teacher, a very sort of strange, shy man, had already had a book or two published, and was in the process of writing what everyone thinks was his masterpiece, which was called The Messiah. And he was sort of taken under the wing of this Nazi, the Nazis were sort of living in the town at this point, and he was sort of that Nazi's Jew. He was hired to paint murals in the this Nazi's daughter's room. And the story, the famous story goes, and David Grossman has written about this in The New Yorker. Some of you may have read it, and now we don't know whether it's true or not. But anyway, one day, sort of, this Nazi shoots another Jew, and to sort of take revenge, somebody comes, another Nazi comes and shoots Bruno Schultz, and you know, you killed my Jew, I killed your Jew. This is the story. anyway, these papers of his, The Messiah and all kinds of other things, stories and so forth that he had, were given a little bit before then to somebody and nobody ever found them, and they, none of them have ever turned up, and there's all kinds of, I don't know, ideas about them lying somewhere in some moldering KGB file, but I doubt they ever will turn up. So there's the sort of writer like Danilo Kiš, the I guess Serbo-Croatian writer, who wrote a most beautiful book, Garden Ashes, which is really so influenced by Schultz in that sort of line of world and characters. Bruno Schultz, this book which I have here is Treatise of Crocodiles. I mean, it's really this kind of strange, private, personal creation of a world where everything is about sort of exposing the deep mythological meaning of things below the surface, the sort of metaphysical core of things. But all through, though, the stories of this family, very autobiographical, it's this child and this father, and the father goes sort of crazier and crazier and gives these amazing, strange soliloquies. And sort of as he becomes more and more the essence of himself and the strange underworld sort of almost ceases to exist. And so Danilo Kiš has this novel which in many ways mirrors that. And then, or like Alexander Hangman, for example, also I think is really influenced in certain ways by Schultz, because you have this sense of the inanimate having life. And I just think of like Hangman has these great things that could have come right out of Schultz, like paper laying the fax machine, like a tongue, something like that. I mean, that's like so Schultzian, if that's a word. And then there's this whole other category of writer like David Grossman, Philip Roth, Cynthia Ozick, and me. It shouldn't really fit in that category, but did only because Bruno Schultz does only because Bruno Schultz became sort of this critical hinge on which one of my books, The History of Love, really hangs in a way. And all of those other writers really, there are characters who either are Bruno Schultz or are almost Bruno Schultz sort of in their work. And I think in that category of writer, it's not just this strange world of the imagination, which is so much more powerful than reality could ever be. So
at that point, I was guided only by writers. And nothing else, no one else. Myself, a sense of what I wanted to achieve. But mainly, you know, I mean, I think a writer is a reader who can't control himself, you know. And so therefore, writes. And so I felt that when I began writing, that was what I felt I was doing. I was reading in the most extreme way I could. But I mean, I was reading also, I mean, one's reading shifts along with one's self and one goes back to things or whatever. I mean, I'm trying to think of who I was reading when I was putting together my first book of stories. I didn't even know I was writing a book, so I don't know.
Well, I was living downstairs from you and you were writing it up there.
What was she reading, Jess?
She was working a lot, she was cooking and working. I don't know what you were reading. That wasn't your first book?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, that's not true. I was finishing that book up, I guess. But I felt like I'd read it. I was sort of on the way out. No, but when I was really, I mean, the beginning of, I mean, I wrote most of that book when I was in Boston, so that's when I got up to Provincetown, where Jess and I both worked together. I was sort of moving on to the next book. Anyway, you know, I was reading a lot of short stories. I was writing short stories. I was trying to teach myself how to write a short story, which I did not know how to do until I tried. So I was reading, you know, I read a lot of Trevor, I read a lot of Chekhov, I read Garcia Marquez's short stories, I read Flannery O'Connor, I read, you know, I read a lot of short stories when I was actually trying to put together my first short stories, because I didn't know how to do it and I wanted to know, you know, where's the instruction manual? Of course, there isn't one other than other writers.